As Europe grapples with an energy crisis and potential supply shocks, it's important to evaluate whether regulatory frameworks are fit for purpose and able to ensure Europe can electrify, decarbonize, and remain competitive. In this episode, Marianne Labatut, European Affairs Director at EDF, shares her perspectives with me regarding policies that are supporting European objectives, as well as regulatory gaps requiring adjustment. She also stresses the need to stay the regulatory course and for Europe to lean into its power sector and grid assets, which provide a strategic advantage at a time when it's needed most. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Marianne, thank you so much for joining me today. We're talking about a number of critical issues, the first of which is the current geopolitical situation and its impact on European energy supplies and the energy situation and the potential for energy shocks. I'd like to get your take on this and where are Europe's biggest pain points?
Thanks. The Europe's biggest pain point is its dependence on imported fossil fuels. Every year, Europe spends 400 billion euros importing oil and gas from other parts of the world. And this is money that is not invested in the European economy. Since the beginning of the crisis in the Middle East, Europe has added over 30 billion euros additional in those imports, due to the increase of prices in fossil fuels. So the signal is very clear. We're having that sort of crisis every 4 years now. If we look back at what happened with the invasion of Ukraine and what is happening now in the Middle East, it is pretty clear that it will happen again. So it's a strong signal for Europe to finally crack this dependence to imported fossil fuels.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying. It's a strong signal. The question is, how can Europe respond to that strong signal? What strategic and realistic choices does Europe have? And perhaps you can delve into some of the policy sides as well.
Europe has a strong advantage. It doesn't have fossil fuel, but it has clean electricity. The power sector is a key asset for the European Union. Electricity in Europe is already decarbonized, around 70%, and this decarbonization continues. It is competitive electricity. It is available. The situation differs in the different member states, but when we look at 2040, the power sector in Europe will be virtually decarbonized. And that's electricity that is produced in Europe, in the different member states, and we can use that to progressively...
So we're receiving the strong signal that action is required, but realistically, what strategic options does Europe have?
The first strategic option that Europe has is to expand the use of electricity in the different sectors, in transport, in industry, in buildings, to use this clean electricity that Europe has to progressively replace the fossil fuels that people and companies are using. Electricity in Europe is already decarbonized, around 70%. By 2040, the European power sector will be virtually fully decarbonized. And therefore, the key asset that we have is our power sector, our grids, which are in general in good shape across Europe, and to help consumers shift from fossil to electricity. This requires investments, CapEx. But at the end of the day, you protect yourself against the variations of fossil prices and you increase your energy security.
I think my next question is, how do we action this? Because it seems as if Europe knows what needs to be done, but how do we get there? How do we start doing this?
Well, first of all, Europe needs to stay on course because we have some good proposals on the table. And the first one is the proposals to shift to electric mobility. The CO2 standards for cars is a very important milestone for electrification. And long-term visibility is required if you really want people to make this shift. So the first recommendation would be to stay the course on the regulatory framework, not to walk back on what has been decided, because these are industry with long investment cycles. And if you change the signals along the way, well, the transition to a more resilient and sovereign Europe will take much more time and will probably be more expensive. So regulatory stability, I would say. And then it's a matter of, let's say, incentivizing member states to put the priority on electrification, to direct public policy and public support to the electrification of end uses. And I hope that the electrification action plan, it will not be legislative, it will be a communication, will give this signal to member states that they can adopt a regulatory framework, objectives, financing tools that help the electrification in transport, buildings, and industry. And we see it happening already. France, for example, adopted a couple of weeks ago an electrification action plan. So details are still in the working, but we hope to see quick results in terms of adoption of electric vehicles and adoption of heat pumps, for instance.
Okay, so we need to stay the course in terms of our regulatory landscape and policy measures. That does indeed make sense. Marin, my next question to you is, EDF recently released a net zero scenario, making recommendations towards achieving some of these goals. Can you tell us more about those recommendations and how they can practically be implemented?
Yes, so we published a net zero scenario. We do that every 2 years. The idea is to shed some light on what trajectory Europe could take to reach net zero in a competitive and more sovereign manner. So to say a few words about the scenario, first of all, it's about decreasing the total energy consumption between now and 2050, the total final energy demand of Europe. So that means electricity plus fossil plus everything reduces by 44%. And at the same time, the share of electricity increases drastically. Right now, you know that we are at around 23% of electricity as a share of Europe's final energy consumption. And that needs to reach around 60-65% by 2050. Then to make it possible to have this electrification, you need to rely on a good mix of low carbon free electricity production, and that is a very large share of renewables and or viable renewables, so wind and solar mostly, and complemented by a strong basis of what we call dispatchable, which means power plants that you can switch on and off as you wish, and that's basically nuclear and hydropower. And it is really important to keep this basis, to have a stable electricity system, to have stable grids, to be able to maintain the frequency, and at the end of the day, to have security of supply. So that's a little bit the outlook of the scenario. If you want me to go a bit deeper into the recommendations, the first one is to prioritize the most cost-effective abatement actions without delay. When you look at electrification, there are no-brainers, things that make sense economically already now. And that's, for example, the electrification of light vehicles. And this generates economic gains already today. So it's mostly a matter of behavioral changes and also to help people put the investment into an electric car. Then we have what we call the low-hanging fruits. And these are investments in technologies that are already sufficiently mature today, but they still require a substantial investment support. And that's basically heat pumps, further investments in the decarbonization of the power sector. Electric trucks come very soon in this list as well. And all the industrial heat production for temperature under 150 to 200 degrees. Because this can be done with heat pumps, industrial heat pumps and e-boilers. We know how to do it. It's quite easy. It's a matter of triggering the investment and so that industrials can then reap the benefits. So that's the first recommendation. Prioritize really the most cost-effective investments. The second is obviously to, in general, accelerate electrification because that boosts competitiveness. And here I'm coming back to a good and stable regulatory framework to ensure that we stay on course. And we need to allow that the support schemes support CapEx and OpEx. We see that some of the support schemes available in Europe at the European level, but also at the member states level, either support CapEx or OpEx. And sometimes you cannot combine the different support schemes. And in our view, if we want to accelerate this shift, it is important to, you know, go a little bit beyond what we usually do and be innovative in the financing schemes, including in the use of the ETS revenues. Today, we don't completely know where all those ETS revenue go in the member states. We really think it needs to be redirected to the electrification of industry. For example, through the decarbonization bank that is being established. The third recommendation that we have is about promoting nuclear power. So, of course, renewables will be further developed. They will represent a huge share of electricity production. But as I said before, nuclear power is decarbonized. It's dense in energy. You install one nuclear power plant and you produce in one site 2 times 1.6 gigawatts, almost baseload. So that's, you know, a lot of power in a very small place, and it's dispatchable. So it provides flexibility and services such as inertia, frequency stability, voltage regulation, and that is absolutely critical. And it's not only about new builds. Of course, there are new projects. France is, EDF is now starting to build 6 new reactors to start replacing the existing fleet. It's also about long-term operation. Many of the existing plants could go to 60 years. Maybe some of them will go to 80 years. And that's a big part of the equation when it comes to keeping a good base of nuclear power in Europe. And then we will have also small modular reactors on top of it. And we are also with Newark developing this technology together with future clients. And here I would like to insist that beyond the very positive political declarations that we've seen recently, with Ursula von der Leyen putting at the same level renewables and nuclear, that's really great. We need to see it happening in every single piece of legislation as well, which is not really the case today. Still, for example, the Commission is preparing a delegated act defining what is an energy efficient data center. At this stage, in the documents we've seen, it's only with renewables. The sourcing with nuclear energy is not taken into account, which is extremely surprising. Hydropower would not be eligible neither. So we need to fill this gap between the political declarations and what comes out of the Commission. And the last recommendation, number 4, is to have a more European systemic approach. Here, we mean a better coordination between national strategies. In France, the TSO does modeling, long-term modeling of the energy system, very detailed with different scenarios. And similar modeling is being done in different member states, but it would be great to have at least a sort of coordination at the regional level, where member states can discuss their energy policy options to better understand each other and also understand the impact of their choices. France will do some new nuclear power plants. This will, of course, have an impact on the region if Spain or Germany decide to do much more solar power. This will also have an impact at the different times of the day on the neighboring countries through the interconnections. And we think that if we want to avoid a huge political tension around energy choices, it would be extremely relevant to have those more detailed conversations at the regional level to avoid frustrations like what happened in Sweden when they said, well, look, if we keep on importing this expensive electricity from the other side of the sea, we'll just close the interconnections at the border. And those sort of very strong reactions keep on happening. And I think better coordination is needed in this sense around the national energy and climate plans in the first place.
Better coordination. I feel like those are such important words, and yet it's so difficult and challenging to achieve that coordination between member states, and each state obviously having its own sort of energy supply, and sort of there's that sentiment of sovereignty or protectionism, perhaps, especially at these times when things are so volatile geopolitically. So my question to you is, you talk about coordination, and we need these detailed conversations at regional strategies. Can we get this to happen? And how? How do we get member states to coordinate and talk? This is a tricky thing, obviously.
I think we need the benefits of this conversation, because in the end, the power system, if you look at the total system costs, including the grid, including the generation assets and the flexibility, will be lower if there is more coordination between the member states. If energy policy is done in isolation, you will have probably more developments, for example, of renewables than what is actually needed. You will curtail more, you will overdevelop some flexibility assets. And in the end, you will have a more expensive system, and those costs at the end of the day go back to the consumers and to industry. So there is a financial benefit to have this political coordination. And I think that could be an argument that impacts policymakers. There is also an argument of, let's say, energy security or electricity system stability, to really know what can be shared between the member states. If I take an example, if you look at a power system in 2035, which would be a compilation of or combination of all the national energy and climate plans, you end up with a system which is 25 billion euros more expensive than in our EDF more optimized scenario, where we have taken, or the model takes, some freedom versus what is in the NECPs, because the model is optimizing the electricity system at the European level, of course, taking into account some national choices and interconnections. But you very quickly see in the modeling, when you try to do an optimized electricity system, that you can save a lot of money with choices that are more articulated rather than the member states going in their individual directions.
So clearly the bottom line has a big influence, I think, on winning member states over. And just on the point of the bottom line, the EDF proposals specifically focus in on nuclear and hydropower. And my question to you is, Marion, is there absolutely no room for gas? So because, you know, obviously we're sitting in a crisis, and that whole idea of we need to keep our long-term decarbonization goals in mind, but also not sacrifice the need for short-term supply. So my question is, where does gas fit into this whole picture?
Yes, it's a very good point. As I said at the beginning, we're moving from, in this optimized scenario, we're moving from 23% electricity to around 64%. That means that the rest needs to be basically molecules, clean molecules, or heating networks. You have solutions as well in district heating that can be powered with electricity, but also with biomass, for instance. So there will be a need for some decarbonized gases, including in the power sector, because to stabilize the system at times of high demand or of low renewable production, you will need some thermal plants. So that's basically gas plants, but that should be running on something clean or be retrofitted with carbon capture and storage. And you will need a substantial amount of that. The question is, how do you produce those clean molecules? So there are, of course, the bioenergy products, biofuels, biogas. There will be as well all the hydrogen and e-fuels, hopefully produced with electrolysis, and then the whole carbon capture and storage. So this will be, in our scenario, still over 20% of the total energy mix. The issue is probably the availability of bioproducts, also looking at sustainability criteria, and how do we manage to ramp up or to kickstart, rather, the production of hydrogen and e-fuels. When we look at the hydrogen strategy of the Commission published in 2020, we're basically nowhere, looking at what they were anticipating for 2025 or 2030. The installed capacity of electrolyzers is extremely low. We're still under 1 gigawatt in Europe. And the rules that have been put in place are extremely complex, to be honest. So we're not really there. We lost a lot of time. And if you want to achieve the full decarbonization of the energy sector and of industry, we need to find a way to produce hydrogen and e-fuels in a competitive manner.
Marin, my final question to you is, in your perfect scenario, if you could see one policy change or one action taken by the political leaders in Europe that would actually be most beneficial, considering the circumstances that we're in now, the global circumstances, the geopolitical circumstances, the need for energy sovereignty, the need for industrial competitiveness. If you could see one change, what would that be?
I think that a change is needed in the support to industry to shift to electricity. Right now, I feel that there is a strong focus on energy intensives, which is a fair focus. But there is an area that is not really tackled at the moment, which is the whole low to medium temperature industrial heat. And that could yield very tangible and fast results in terms of electrification of end uses. So I hope that the electrification action plan would put the emphasis on those more diffuse sectors, but also that, for instance, the decarbonization bank will be finally established, that it will really focus on electrification and not start financing CCS, for instance, and that it will focus as well on those low-hanging fruits in the industrial sectors, because once we get this ball rolling of electrification of the rest of the industry that is not so visible here in Brussels, we will have made a huge step forward in terms of achieving this electrification agenda.
Thank you for sharing that. I know it's not easy to pinpoint one thing, but I do appreciate it, Marin. And thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And thank you so much to our listeners. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Logg, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.